We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
In Olympic judo, only one athlete per weight class can go to the Olympics for each country. In 2012, the United States had an unprecedented situation. Two judoka from the 73-kilo weight class both qualified for the Olympics by being ranked in the top 22 in the world. So in May 2012, they had to face each other at the Miami World Cup to determine which one gets to go to the Olympics in London. I am talking to one of those guys today. He is Nick DelPopolo, ranked number one in the U.S. and top 10 in the world. And in May 2012, a year and a half ago, he had to face Michael Eldred, number two ranked, for the spot. Nick, do you remember the days leading up to that contest? Were you stressed out?
No, I wasn't stressed out. I just wanted to get out on the mat and fight. It was really just anxiety. I really wanted to get out on the mat and just kind of get it over with, you know, just to know if I was going to be an Olympian or not, you know.
Right, but it seems to me like in judo, more than maybe the other grappling sports like wrestling or jiu-jitsu, like a single mistake can cost you the match.
Yeah. That's why I guess stress is the right word. There is a higher degree of stress because it's so, you know, instantaneous. It can just, oop, it's over. You lost, you know, so it's, but, you know, with a guy like Michael, and I'm not taking anything away from him, you know, we faced each other, I think, leading up to that day, I think 16 times we've played each other before that series of matches that day. And I wasn't really too worried about losing by ippon or via throw. I was more, for me and the way I matched up with Michael, I was more or less worried about, you know, taking a passivity shido or you know, a stepping out of bounds shido, because he's in decent shape and he likes to push the pace. So that's the kind of style he would play against me. I get a shido, the match is almost always over if I got a shido against him, because he's in great shape. He's got good tactics. He's smart. He can stay away. So I wasn't so worried about getting thrown. I was just worried about losing a 5-minute 1-0 in terms of shido match. You know what I mean? Or 2-1. 2-1, he wins. You know, I'd rather lose by ippon, but not that way. But that's, realistically speaking, that was the way I knew I would probably lose if I were to lose.
Right, so that's exactly, actually, in terms of shido, is what happened. So you were ranked number one,
yep.
And Eldred was ranked number two, and so if you had won the first match, it would have been over and you'd get the spot. But if you lose the first match, then it goes to best 2 of 3. So you lost the first match on shidos, right?
The first match, I was down by a shido. I got a quick shido, and I, you know, in my head I said, okay, here we go. This is exactly what I didn't want to happen. And I kind of put into his hands. So then, you know, I'm not losing the match, but I'm still down by a shido. So I'm this thing back in my head saying, you know, you're technically losing. In a referee's decision, you'd probably lose too. So probably about halfway through overtime in that first match, you know, I'm kind of, you know, after every hajime, you know, I'm kind of running at him, just kind of lunging myself out of him. And sure enough, he gets under me with sumi geishi for a yuko. And, you know, I just had too much forward momentum. I couldn't stop myself.
So then in the first match of the best 2 of 3.
I ended up beating him. We went back and forth, back and forth.
Right, got perfect. So it was, but it ended up being 4 matches. And
right.
So it went down to the last match.
Right.
That you won in spectacular fashion with the Kosoto for ippon.
Right.
So that puts you on the Olympic team. So how did it feel to, you know, to win that final match in dramatic fashion and like truly earn the spot? You know, like you.
One thing about my judo and the type of judo I try to play is I try to win by ippon. You know, I try not to make it like a questionable debate, you know, oh, did he win? Did he not win? Was the match scored properly? If it's ippon, you know, that's the whole, really the essence of the sport is trying to score ippon. So if you worry about scoring ippon, ideally your mentality is right. You're worried about being offensive. You're worried about doing what you can do to get the guy on his back, or, you know, choke him, arm bar him, pin him, whatever you can do to score your opponent. And to win by your opponent was a nice feeling, you know. And I mean, win however way you got to win, but winning by your opponent really means you went for it, you know, or you, you know, you just get it. You get judo, you know. You're trying to win the best way you can, and that's what I was proud of. And also, it was cool to do it in front of my parents and girlfriend and team and everybody. That was cool. Everybody that I wanted to be down there to see that, you know, moment of my life happen was down there. So that was very cool. That was more cool than anything. I got to do it in front of people I love.
Yeah, that's awesome. Since you're talking about Ippon, I have to then mention the Olympics. You won your first two matches. And in your third match in the quarterfinals, you faced Ki Chung Wang, 2008 silver medalist and two-time world champ.
Right.
It went down to no score, right? To no score.
Right.
You went five minutes, and then the golden score. And this is arguably the biggest match of your life. I mean,
right.
How did it feel to get a loss from a referee decision in that match?
That's what I'm talking about. That's kind of what I was leading to before. That's one of the worst ways to lose, you know, because you left it completely in another person's hands. That really is no business deciding the fate of a judo match. It's yours to decide. You know, if you want to lose, you can go out there and lose. That's easy. If you want to win, it's in theory, it's also really easy. You know, to do what you have to do to win. If I could have done 15% more, even 10% more, I think I would have won that match. And that's what really stinks about that, because you had to lay in bed that night saying, you know, it wasn't that I wasn't good enough. It's that I didn't apply myself enough in that match, you know, or I didn't play particularly right. You know, there's something I didn't do right, and I was good enough, or I was capable enough today, you know, and that's what really stunk about that.
Yeah, that match probably has to stay with you for the rest of your life, really.
Yeah. Probably. I mean, it doesn't like hurt, but there's a lot to think about in that match. You know, it's pretty much my whole, you know, I can watch that match, that one match, no other matches from my whole career, and I can be like, well, you know, there's my problem in a nutshell. I'm just not offensive enough, or I'm not, you know, tactical enough. Just that little extra 10%, I win, you know.
Well, I saw a match of you. So you faced him several times before, and I saw a match of yours against him in, I think, 2011. I'm not sure where. Do you remember where that was, the Grand Prix?
Germany.
Well, so this one was, you both scored two Azaris.
It's in France, okay. The Worlds, actually, at a team tournament.
And that was an amazing match. So at the, I don't know if you remember it, but I have a couple questions about it. Unlike your 2012 Olympics match, you guys were able to score a lot. Mm-hmm. And at the 1 minute mark, actually, you started off. You had a really good pin.
Yeah, yeah.
I wasn't sure why the ref didn't call it a pin.
Neither was I, but I guess my head wasn't placed properly on his chest or on his torso, so they didn't say. You know, they didn't have enough control. So.
But the control in that pin really came a lot from like the grip and.
Right. That's what I thought too. I was like, you know. The way my body's positioned on this guy's torso and where my hands are, where his hands are, to me it really seems like this should be a pin, you know. I didn't need much either, you know. I didn't need much time, so that stunned him to get a score there. But I know exactly the match you're referring to. I come out, I almost pin him, and then I think the very next exchange or two, he throws me with that, you know, that devastating drop Taitoshi. And you know what stinks too? It's left on right, you know, I'm grabbing him, and it's almost impossible to get the inside grip on this guy. It's almost impossible. So you're going to have to, you know, going into the match, you got to tell yourself, look, you're going to have to try to function with the outside grip and be offensive with an outside or a less superior grip, you know, and you're going to have to go immediately and make it count, because the guy didn't give you any chance to wait around. So you have to make whatever you come in for, you have to make really count. He's coming in for that. I've seen it now three or four times, that low tie-o. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, when it's happening and you're moving in that direction, you're like, it's like in slow motion, like, I'm going to get thrown with drop tie-o. And then sure enough, you're on your back and you're like, I got thrown with drop. That's so stupid, you know. But then I think he tried it again. And I think this time I kept my hands on and I had a better grip. My left hand was on his right tricep. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of, I completely changed the direction to counter back for Wazari with, I wouldn't know how, just some simple counter.
I think it was a Kosoto, maybe.
Yeah, you could call it that. Yeah. Yeah, it was. It really was. Like, yeah, that's what it was, I guess.
I actually thought both of you, the throw you, like, the way he threw you and the way you threw him were, should have been both epons.
They were both epons. Yeah, I lost the match before I even threw him, I think. I think he threw me, and I remember I jumped because I was like, if I don't jump, I'm gonna land flat on my back. So at least this way, you know, it'll look really cool, but at least this way they may call Wazari, and sure enough, they did.
Yeah, it's like an overthrow or something.
Yeah. And then with him, he kind of did the same thing. I was tilting him over, and he could feel himself going, and I could feel himself, like, catapult himself onto his own side. So, you know, I thought they were both Ippon, too. I was really hoping when I threw him, I was like, oh, please call Ippon. And then I look up, and I'm like, oh, my God. One ref's got his hand up for Ippon, and the other two are like, no, it's Wazari, and it's oh, my God, are you sure it's Wazari? It's a pretty good throw, you know?
So. Well, what does it feel like, with a pin? That could have been an Ippon as well. With a pin, how does it feel when a ref makes arguably a bad call? Does it have a mental effect on you in the match?
You know, it used to, but that's something that, you know, you have very, very, very little control over, you know. So what you can control in that outcome is like I said, is what you, the way you fight, going for Ippon, being offensive, you know, showing your referee you're not tired, showing him your only priority is to try to score. That's what you can control, and I think if you do that to the best of your ability, you really have nothing to be mad at or bitter about, you know. And if the referee goes against you, you know, that's just the name of the game. It's an unforgiving sport. Sometimes it's going to go against you, and sometimes it's going to go for you. So as long as you keep that in mind, I don't really think that, you know, there's not a whole lot of good, you know, crying over a referee's call. You know, it's going to happen. It's inevitable. And when and they're human. They make mistakes, or they see things a different way, and it's something you have to understand, you know.
Right.
I remember... I think you were there for this, actually. About 2 years ago, what? I actually fought Travis Stevens in New Jersey.
Yeah. I remember that.
This, like, super duper, you know, they had this cool idea where they, you know, each winner of the senior division, kind of like the jiu-jitsu tournaments or grappling tournaments, had to go in, like, an absolute division, and we all fought each other. It was really cool, and Travis and I fought each other. Nothing, taking nothing away from Travis, but he throws me with Sumi off the edge of the mat into this other mat, into a referee.
Mm-hmm.
And the referee calls Yuko, and you know everyone's like, this is kind of, you know, he's hands on the other mat. This is kind of weird, and you know they called Yuko. I couldn't get the score back. I lose, and even if it was like a big match, it was just some local tournament at I think Tony Kamau's tournament, I believe, in New Jersey, the Northeast Invitational they have every winter. I think that's where I fought him, and you know, I really wanted to win that match. You know, I really did.
That was a battle.
Yeah, it's a good win if you win that match, you know. It's a good, nice win, and it's a good fight, and I lost. To me, driving home, it was, man, I can't believe that. The referee called Yuko. I landed on the other mat into another referee. What is that, you know? And I thought to myself, you know, if it was the other way around, and, you know, if I'm Travis, I'm not saying anything, you know. It's,
right.
Oh, sweet, good call, you know. So then it just happens. You're going to get some, you're not going to get some, and I can remember a ton of calls that went my way, so I have nothing to complain about. You know, there's going to be a ton more that go against me, and then a ton more that go for me. So, knowing that, if you just keep that in mind and keep what I said before about, you know, positive, you know, offensive mentality, you'll be okay. There's nothing that I have nothing to sneeze at there. Referees are human; they're going to make human error, and I'm not always right either. Sometimes my perspective might be wrong too. So. I understand that.
Well, actually, I think it's the first time I've gotten introduced to your girlfriend, Carrie Chandler, at that tournament.
Mm-hmm.
She was very passionately arguing with the ref about the how bad the call was.
Yeah, she wasn't happy.
So do you think that's, you know, different sports have different kind of... cultures in terms of arguing with the ref, and some sports...
Sure.
Is that something that it almost looked like arguing with the ref in that case would work against you?
Right.
Or does it really not matter? I mean, I think it was Billy that was reffing, and he's a good ref, so it's like...
She thought it wasn't a score. I thought it wasn't a score. A lot of people, just in that particular instance, thought it wasn't a score. But look, like, at least in my opinion, while I'm out there, and if a call I don't think is going my way, there's not really a whole lot I can do about it. Complaining about it, while you're only out there for 5 to 10 minutes, you know, being negative, throwing your arms up, you know, causing a scene, isn't, you're wasting valuable minutes of energy. You know, after the fact, you can complain, you know, but during it, it's not going to help. You know, it's really not going to help. And so,
in terms of like passivity and stuff, do you think, acting, frustrated with your opponents, you know, like pretending like he's not letting you do anything, that kind of acting, can influence the ref?
No, maybe influencing the, not give the guy a shootout. They're going to go against you 9 times out of 10. If you're, you know, just play the match. You know, I, when I was younger, even still to this day, there's times when I'm playing a guy and I'm, you know, if he's, you know, he's doing, if I think he's doing a false attack, I'll kind of look at the ref like, you know, what was that? He just got out of the exchange, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Or if, for instance, he has an illegal grip, you know, you can look at the referee and like kind of show him the grip, but you know what? You probably shouldn't do that, you know, because
it's in the
middle of combat. The guy's got his grip, you know, if it's an illegal grip, it's probably a pretty favorable grip. Why would you spend any moment looking at a referee saying, hey, he's got an illegal, it's not going to help, you know? So
right.
Just play the match, worry about all that other crap later. And then, you know, technically if you're good enough, it shouldn't affect you, you know? So to me, it doesn't matter. It doesn't pay. I used to be all over the referees, and then, I think 1 year at the Morris Cup, I tried refereeing, and then I got the other. I saw it from a different perspective, and I said, "Man, that's really tough. I'm not going to do that again." So,
thankless job. Yeah.
Yeah, tough. It's tough. So.
So in your, after that tough loss on the referee decision against Kichun Wang in the quarters, you had to face Mongolian Niemocher Sanjigal. He is currently actually ranked number one in the world,
mm-hmm.
in the rankings I saw recently.
Right.
You lost to him by Yuko. Have you fought him before that? Before
then?
Yeah,
we fought 2 years in 2 years in a row at the Paris Grand Slam. The first year I beat him 2 shidos to 1. The next year, he beat me 2 shidos to 1, and at the Olympics he beat me 2 shidos to 1. So. In that match, it's, see, again, it's a tactical match. It's not going to be like, I'm not worried about, he's a dynamic scorer, he's a big thrower, but I'm not worried about him throwing me, because he can't. You know, we fought 3 5-minute matches, and he couldn't throw me, not one time. So I'm not worried about, I'm not ever really worried about guys throwing me. What I'm worried about is taking a shido, and then being behind by that shido the whole match. You know, like
right.
I said, 1-0, 2-1, 3-2, down by shido, it's tough for me to come back, you know? So that's what I'm mostly worried about. I'm not ever really worried about, if I lose from a score, like actually getting thrown, I sleep way better at night. If I lose by a shido, it's the worst.
Yeah.
So I lost by a shido at the Olympics to Sanjigal. It was 2-1. And, I mean, technically it's Yuko, but I lost from a passivity shido, or I think 2 passivity shidos. To his 1 false attack, so that's the worst. It just didn't do enough. It feels, ugh.
After losing to Kishan Wang, what was your mental state like? I mean, like this means that you can't get a gold medal. Were you able to put that quarterfinals match behind you?
Immediately. There was no downtime, negativity. Well, it was immediate. I lost. It was okay. It didn't matter because you're still in the tournament. There's, why would you, you know, think about it? It's over. It's out of your hands. There's nothing you can do about it. Lost fair and square. Okay, get ready for the next match, you know. So there was no, you know, to answer your question, there was no quarterfinal drag. You know, it wasn't like a slump or I lost and I couldn't recover. I played to my best ability, and I played to my best ability again. There was no, you know what I mean? There was no, can't blame it on that. I just lost fair and square twice, you know. You know, I recovered mentally fine. There was no.
But you go home at the end of the day with nobody actually having scored on you
right.
in a judo way, in a non-judo
right.
way.
No, yeah, that's, you know, because when the tournament's over, I'm done, I'm sitting there, and I'm saying, man, I probably could have done something today had I gone just a little differently, you know. So, because, I mean, when you lose a referee's decision and 2-1, in the Olympic quarterfinal and the match to get in for bronze, you know, you're just shreds away. You know, you're just decimals away. Not, it's nothing. You know, it's That's how close it is. That's how fine that margin is. So that's what you think about a lot. It's like, man, what would have made a difference there? You know, so if it's like getting up for one more run or doing some tactical, anything could have helped that, you know, or just, I don't know. It's so close that that's what, if you run out there and you get thrown a free pawn in a minute, okay, fine. There's not a whole lot to think about. But if you run out there and you play a 5-minute match with one of the best guys in the world,
yeah,
you almost score a couple times. He can't score on you. It's really close. Man, you know, there's a lot to think about there, you know. So it's that's what kind of hurts about that is being close, you know. But it's just motivation to push harder.
Yeah, I mean, that's why people, I think, love watching the Olympics is the drama of that, you know, that you can sort of feel the pain of the athletes. Yeah, you could certainly feel it. But so after you competed, the IOC said that you tested positive for a chemical found in marijuana. And as people can imagine, if you've ever been on the internet, this spurred a million conversations online, blog posts, tweets, Facebook comments, all that. I won't say any more about the events around that, nor ask you to comment, but it reminded me of the tragic absurdity of the case of Bakava Buida of Mongolia. He's a judoka that was stripped of his silver medal in judo after an amazing performance at the 72 Olympics in Munich because he had elevated levels of caffeine in the system.
Are you serious? Wow.
I think as of 2000, I'm not sure, but I think 2000, they've changed the caffeine ruling. But
yeah,
you know, you weren't allowed to have like more than a couple cups of coffee or whatever. Being stripped of your silver medal for something, I don't want to say a silly rule because all rules are rules, but it's a tough, absurd kind of thing. But in those several months after the Olympics, when I'm sure you were flooded with the wrong kind of attention from the wrong kind
right.
of people,
yeah.
How were you able to just maintain focus on your training and just get over all of that?
But to tell you the truth, there's that you know, 4 or 5 month period where basically I'm kind of a villain, you know, and or to most people and people, you know, that I've known my whole life or that I've worked with for a long time, just kind of dropped me like a bad habit. Boop, done. Yeah. And so that kind of gave me, so I saw that and I learned really quickly, like, oh man, like people are really quick to drop you, you know, if they're not happy with you. So I didn't have a whole lot of friends. So it was easier to, you know, put all the bull aside because I didn't have to talk to anybody, I didn't have to deal with anybody. No one wanted to deal with me. Mm-hmm. So I just train. All of a sudden, you know, I'm eligible again. I compete. I do well. And then all these people that I haven't heard from in 4, 5, 6, 7 months that, you know, bash me or just drop me, giving me calls saying, good job. It's okay. Good to see you back. And, oh, I can't believe you, you know, persevered that and whatnot. And, man, right. I couldn't tell you how bad I just wanted to be like, get out of here, you know. But
that's the way the world works.
Yeah,
right?
And that's it. And I think maybe I was gullible or maybe I just I don't know. I just never experienced that. But to have so many people just say, forget about you, you know. I learned a really important life lesson that those 5 or 6 months, you know, it's kind of like, what have you done for me lately? Or what have you done for us lately? You know, you got to keep performing and keep being this thing you're supposed to be. And then when it doesn't go right or it goes haywire, people were just so quick to be like, get out of here, you know, and then I'm not doing anything for you, get lost, you're done. And then when it's over, then you win, you know, this, that, and the other thing. And then people are so quick to, you know, I think that's just the world we live in. I think you said it right. So it was okay. But, It to answer your question about training, at least, it was really easy to train. No one was really bothering me, so I wasn't really bothered by anybody, so it was really easy to train, and I didn't have to worry about anything but judo.
Did you look at any stuff online, anything like that?
Down the road I did, and
is it tough? Because the stuff I looked at, there's a lot of people that don't know anything about judo, don't know anything about you, don't know anything about what it takes to be an Olympic athlete. And they're just commenting on.
Yeah, not a lot of people. I'm not going to go into specifics about it, but not a lot of people know the whole the real whole story, the whole detailed information about what happened there. And, you know, and it's okay for people to comment because, you know, I get on the internet sometimes, I'll read a story about a celebrity and I'll say, you know, what an idiot, you know.
Yeah, right.
Or I'll post something. I'm probably not, but, you know, every now and then I might post something. I'll be like, but I don't know. Some negative thing about some superstar athlete or celebrity. And then, you know, I'll find myself thinking, I'm like, man, that kind of stunk when you were up there and they're all taking shots that you probably shouldn't do that, you know. So, you know, looking at it online, I looked at a couple of things online and there are some tough things to see. And there are some things to see that I deserved and things to see that I didn't deserve. And the toughest thing is, you know, I get some people inside the judo community, outside the judo community, outside the grappling community, inside of it, who whatever, they're telling me to my face, you know, or behind my back or through Facebook or whatever, through email, but to my face hurts the most, you know, that I'm not a good guy or I'm a bad guy, you know, and that's the worst, that I'm not a bad guy. I don't think,
yeah, of all, you know, people, like, I think if there's such a thing as a good guy, I think you're in the judo community, at least a very good representative of that.
Yeah. And like, that's right. And that's what I try to think, you know, I really appreciate that. And that's what I, you know, I try to pride myself on, you know, I try to help everyone if they need to be helped. I try to treat people the way I want to be treated. You know, and I genuinely try to help out, and that's kind of sucked because people were just taking shots at me for my, you know, my attitude, my behavior, which is okay, but then they're also saying I'm not a good guy. You know, I'm a, there's a ton of explicits out there, but, you know, I'm a piece of crap. I'm, you know, a drug addict and all this stuff. And it's like, no, man, that's not like that at all. If I could just get you just to listen to me for 5 minutes and tell my side of the story, I don't think you think I'm a bad guy. And B, I think I'd convince you that it was one big mishap, you know, and I'm not a bad guy. I did mess up.
Absolutely, man. So. I mean, people that know you don't need an explanation. So it's they know you're a good person. And this situation is absurd and silly. But
sorry to interrupt real quick, but to stay on the same subject, they actually right after I tested, they actually changed the rule for how much THC is allowed in your system. Because, you know, there was so much outcry when I tested positive. People were like, a lot of people, especially people in the, you know, in within the IOC and their committee, they were, this is stupid, you know. What,
right.
That's so dumb. How is that even sports enhancing? So they changed the rule. I mean, basically, I think Nick Diaz, when he tested positive for that one fight, whatever, you know, the threshold is, I think he was at 175, whatever the units are.
Right.
I suppose it's a lot. So now the new threshold is 175. So you basically have to really, really, really try. You have to put in some effort to fail. I think I was 19, whatever the unit is, 19.
Right.
And the threshold was 15 at the Olympics. It's super low. To get a job in the United States, you have a drug test, and it's 50 and under to be not detectable. But at the Olympics, it was 15 and under. So it was like anything would have sparked that, and it didn't need much, you know. So it was, I just missed it, or I just failed, and it really stunk, you know.
You know, all the details of that, it's almost as tragic as the as your loss on the referee decision.
Yeah.
You know, it's all part of it. It's all part of the drama. It'll make your when your autobiography comes out, it'll make it a hell of a good book.
No, I know. Hopefully, it's leading in. I'm leading into the best chapters of my story. You know, so the comeback, the revival.
Yeah, exactly. It'll be good stuff for Hollywood, for the movie.
Yeah.
It's good stuff, man.
It's totally.
But stay on the subject just a little longer. Did you struggle in terms of financial support? I imagine.
Yeah, I really hurt bad there for a while. You know, because, you know, you lose everybody. Everyone wants nothing to do with you. You lose your sponsors. You lose your finances. So, and then it kind of happened at the worst time, too, because the Olympics just happened. Your Super Bowl just happened. What's your value now? You didn't get a medal. You got kicked out. And now, it doesn't matter. I mean, kind of technically, it doesn't matter for another 4 years. You know, what am I paying you for? What are we paying you for? You know, or what are we sponsoring you for? Anyways, that 6 months you were talking about, where I kind of had to go through that, you know, it wasn't just, you know, putting my head down and when I walk through crowds or, you know what I mean? It was, I don't have any money. I can't live. I can't train. It was really, really, that was probably as bad as it's going to get for me.
Did you ever, in those months, did it ever seem that you might not be able to continue competing in judo? And
no, that's never really a possibility. It's never a possibility. That's something that's, I'd probably have to die, you know, knock on wood. I'd probably have to die to stop competing. Because, I mean, I remember 3 or 4 years ago, I didn't know it, but I had mono. And I was training and, you know, I was trying so hard to improve. Training so hard, lifting, running, doing 2-3 judo workouts a day in Boston at Jimmy Pedro's. And, you know, I would lift a weight, you know, 2 minutes into the workout, I was depleted. I was dead. I'd go for a run, 2 or 3 minutes into the run, I felt like I had asthma. You know, I'd start working out in judo, do a little bit of randori, I was kaput, I was dead. And then, you know, I suffer all these losses. I'm losing the guys I've never lost to before. You know, they're throwing me for a pawn. I don't get thrown for a pawn. It's just like, what is going on? Losing all this confidence.
So you push through all that? And just
yeah.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. And then at that moment, you know, when I lost to a couple of certain people that I just didn't think I could ever lose to. So I was like, oh, man, maybe I stink. Maybe I'm done. You know, I shouldn't do judo anymore. And my mom said, you know, you should probably go to the doctor, get it looked at, you know, see if you feel okay, get everything looked at, and, you know, okay, fine. Sure enough, I have mono, you know, for the last 6 months, and they said, you're not resting, that's why you're not getting better, you know, I mean, you know, oh, my God. So then that, you know, as soon as I rested after that, you know, immediately they went to the next tournament afterwards, and then I immediately do better, but I didn't quit then, I didn't quit, you know, after the Olympics, I'm not going to quit. I would seriously have to probably die. You know, yeah.
it would take a lot.
Yeah, it really would. It really would.
Well, in a recent interview of yours that I read, you mentioned that you're a fan of Game of Thrones, and you said that your two favorite characters are the Hound and the little guy. What's his name? Tyrion.
Right.
To leave this topic, let me give you advice from Tyrion. A quote. He's yours and my favorite character. This is his advice to Jon Snow, the illegitimate son of Lord Stark.
Right.
He said, never forget what you are, for surely the world will not. Make it your strength, arm yourself in it, and it will never be used to hurt you. So,
That's your advice? That's your Tyrion advice for me?
Exactly, yeah.
I love it. All right. I know exactly what episode you're talking about. Yeah. They're on top of the wall. I remember. No, I love that. It's a great show, man. Great show.
So both the Hound, by the way, as long as we're on the topic, and Tyrion are, I would say, outcasts of sort. They're,
yeah, that's why. I think that's why they're my favorites. They're outcasts, and they're... You know, they're deeply involved in the game, but you don't really see them coming, and I think they're going to have a major impact on the overall Game of Thrones. I've read the books, but I've only read up to the story on TV. I won't read past it, you know, because
right.
the TV, I mean, usually the books are almost always better than the movie or the show, but the show is just so good, I don't want to spoil it for myself, so I can't read
right.
it.
I mean, I'm kind of fascinated by them because they're both flawed. In sort of fundamental ways, they're like as vulgar as it gets in terms of sex and violence, but
right.
they're both like strong characters. Like they're at the core good human beings.
Yeah, right.
Why do you think people find those two interesting? Like with that kind of dichotomy of being rejected by society, like they're not seen as good human beings, I think, by...
Well, right. First of all, they're playing, you know, the Game of Thrones, and first of all, anyone who plays, almost immediately, you know, at least to the people in I can't remember what their world's called, but the people of that world, you know, if you're playing the Game of Thrones, you're almost immediately viewed as a villain or,
right.
you know, negative, so in a negative light. So then these two guys, you know, you said they're good human beings, and they are good human beings. The Hound saves the Stark girl, and he mm-hmm. saves the other Stark girl. You know, you can tell he's a decent guy deep down, but people are afraid of him because of his appearance and his job and the way he carries himself. And Tyrion, he's a good guy, too. He saves a Stark girl. He doesn't have relations with the Sansa Stark because,
yeah.
you know, she's scared. And so he doesn't, and he cares about that his girlfriend a lot. He loves her. He's a good guy, too. But they're all just playing the game. They all want a piece of the pie. So that's what, and they, you know, they're viewed in a negative light. Their appearance, both their appearance is a little bit hard for people to take in. But I think that's why I like them. That's why they appeal to me. They're both good guys. You just wouldn't know it. And you talk to him, and you're like, hey, they're an okay guy. He just wants a piece of the Game of Thrones. That's all. He just wants up top.
Well, I think of Tyrion as kind of the lover and the Hound as the fighter.
Right.
So if you had to pick, well, which do you personally relate to more, the lover or the fighter?
The lover, man, the lover. And not like romance
in that world,
so
yeah.
much. But if I had to choose loving or fighting, I got to choose loving, man. I can't. I'm not a fighter. It's just realistic,
yes.
realistically speaking. I think if you ask a lot of people, a lot of them, you know, will say one thing or the other, but I think most people are lovers and it should be that way.
So in going back to judo, your journey in judo, let me see if I got this right. I did a little bit of research. So you started judo when you were 5. That's about 19 years ago. You went, that was in Cranford under Yoshisada Yonezuka. There you
yeah.
go. At 8, you began wrestling. At 12, you went to Jason Morris. You went up to upstate New York to Jason's. And then you came back in high school at 14.
That's right.
And you started wrestling. And in sophomore year, you hurt your knee real bad. And
That's
after
right.
after the recovery, which I have a bunch of questions about there, but after that recovery, you went back to Jason's. And stayed there until 2008, I believe, and then
yep.
and then you trained at Jimmy Pedro's for until 2011, and you returned to Jason, and with his blessing, after the 2012 Olympics, you moved to where you are at now, right?
You're in Miami. Correct. Yep.
Oh, damn. It's pretty
yeah.
good. I need to edit your Wikipedia page. Add that all that stuff.
Thanks.
In terms of coaches, like watching that 2011 match of yours against Ki Chung Wang, you had Jimmy in your corner, Jimmy
right.
Pedro, and I can hear him yelling like, "Come on, kid, pull him in!" Like on that pin, he was like, "Pull him
right.
in on this Osakomi," and then just the yelling in that typical good way, like, "Come on, you want it more," doing all that kind of stuff. Can you talk about the role of your coaches, of Jimmy and Jason Morris, in your competition
yeah,
career?
Absolutely. You know, first of all, both Jimmy and Jason were good players during their time.
Right.
And, you know, that doesn't necessarily always translate to a good coach, you know, and I mean in that in both ways. You know, when you're a good player, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be a good coach. Or if you're a bad player, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be a bad coach. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You can be you could have been a terrible player, but be a really good coach, or vice versa. You can be a great athlete and being a terrible coach. These guys are the exception. They're both phenomenal athletes. You know, by their resumes, you can just tell. If you were around to watch their judo, it was awesome.
Yes.
And then they made the coaching transition really well. But the interesting thing about those two guys, and I've worked with them both extensively, is they have kind of different approaches. You know, Jason's got more of a stylistic, dynamic throwing approach. You know, win by poem, more of a Japanese approach. Whereas Jimmy's got a
gripping.
I'm not going to call it like a European feel, but it feels more of a, it's got that European like feel. It's more tactical. There's gripping. There's, well, you know, lots of kumikata, lots of tactics, it's a lot of match flow and, you know, how to handle and dictate a match rather than just going for your opponent. And I'm not saying that's what Jason does. I'm just saying just kind of two different approaches, two different ways of going about the thing, you know. So when you take both, you know, Jimmy's got the newaza and the gripping and the tactics, the strategy, and Jason's got the dynamic judo, the throwing, the scoring, the tachiwaza, you know. So if you take both of those things and you put them together,
yeah,
you kind of have a
complete package.
Me, which is a watered down version of them, and hopefully I can, you know, take both of those styles and use my own style to make me, you know, and be able
yeah.
to have a little more success. I mean, honestly, man, I just need a victory at each more tournament, and I got a medal at all these tournaments. You know
yeah.
what I'm saying? So it's
yeah.
like, won't take too much more, but in terms of those guys coaching me, whenever they're there, and they have a little bit of a different approach coaching too. They're both, you know, of course, very good, but Jimmy's more of, again, he's tactical. There's strategy. It works out great with Jimmy because he was formerly 73 kilos
right.
by weight category. So he knows a lot of the guys. He knows the pace. He knows the speed, the style, right. the feel, the flow of the match. You know, he knows all these guys inside and out at 73. So, you know, obviously having him there is good. He's very positive in the chair, you know, as you can tell.
Yeah.
He's saying, come on, kid, you can do it. And he really makes you believe, you know, it doesn't matter if there's, you know, dare I say, God himself standing in front of you. He'll make you believe you have a chance to beat God himself.
Yes.
And Jason's a lot of the same, you know, in that respect. You know, walking out to the mat, Jason, he'll tell you straight up, he's, you know, this is up to you. You know, you're good enough to win. You just got to show yourself, me, and all these other people you're good enough to win. You know, there's right. nothing to be afraid of. You can do this, you know. And
do you like detailed instructions? Like
I love it.
I heard Jimmy yell like, "Don't give him that lapel." He sets up everything up from that grip.
Yep. I need cliff notes every now and then. You know, I need like someone to tell me a very quick, subtle thing like that. You know, if I have someone there that's telling me just little subtleties like that. It actually affects me. It does really help. I play better. Whereas this happens a lot with me. You know, I travel alone. I don't compete with the coach. You just compete. It's okay. You can kind of do you, but then you're just kind of doing Rondori. You know, you're not really, you're kind of just winging it, you know, and if you're good enough, yeah, you can win without a coach, fine. But let's not act like a coach doesn't help, especially one that knows what he's doing. If Jimmy Pedro's in my chair or Jason Morris is in my chair or any other established coach with all these credentials is in my chair and they want me to win and they're trying to help me, you know, 9 times out of 10, it's probably going to help, you know, whereas as opposed to nothing. So, and both those guys, they genuinely care if you win, you know, they really want you to win.
Yeah. They look like it. There's a lot of passion. It's actually fun to watch as a spectator. It's actually entertaining, even more entertaining. Cause like, it feels like there's a relationship between you and the coach and like you're both really invested in this win.
And I think you are, you know, I think I think you just hit the nail right in the head. We're both really invested. It's not just about what I've given up. It's about what they've given up too. You know, Jimmy's got a family. Jason's got a family. Jason's got two little girls. Jimmy's got, you know, four kids, all different ages, you know, wives, jobs, they're working their tails off. And then, you know, to give up this time for me and, you know, the other athletes to go halfway around the world in Abu Dhabi, God knows where, you know,
yeah,
be personally invested in this match or any match for that matter is, you know, you really can't ask for more. And that's, and I think at least from Jimmy and Jason's standpoint, you know, they were former competitors at a very, very high level. So then when they get into a high-level match with a high-level opponent and, you know, the stakes are high and the intensity is high, they get into it. They can't help it. It's natural. They almost feel like they want to get out. They tell me all the time, like, I wish I could get out there for you and do it for you or tell you or show you mid-match or take a timeout and just show you. But, you know, and that's something you can't really ask for more than that. That's what you want, you know.
I mean, I've seen you write about struggling to go to some of these major international competitions without a coach. Is that something that you think is really tough?
Well, of course it's tough. You know, I mean, I hate to sound so as a matter of fact about it, but it is really tough. You know, you look at you, I mean, I'll just tell you this year, you know, I show up to the Moscow Grand Prix, you know, and I'm not going to get into specifics, but the whole trip was a nightmare. Everything went wrong. Everything that could have gone wrong, pretty much gone wrong. You know, at least my plane didn't go down, thank God. But I mean, I'm there, you know, and I like, it's, you know, I don't have a room, this, that, and the other thing. Everything's gone wrong, sour, down. And I didn't have a coach there or a manager there with me because it was on me. I chose to do that because I knew no one was going to go, but I still said I wanted to go. And, you know, I got to sign myself in. I got to figure out this whole money thing. Got to figure out how to get into a room. Got to figure out where this all went wrong all by myself while I have to focus on competing in 2 days, you know? So it's like, and I got to make weight and I got to, you know, it's a lot of doing everything by yourself. You can do it, but it does take its toll, you know? And then at that tournament in particular, you know, I'm fighting in the quarterfinal, I believe. I'm fighting this Italian guy and I'm not really fighting well. I didn't have a good tournament. Just didn't have a good tournament or good trip at all. But I believe I threw him. He came in for some sort of uchimata or harai, and I I Sukashi'd him. I stepped over him.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so quick and it was so fast. I just reacted. And, it was really quick throw. It was just over him, like, that quick.
Yeah.
It was hard for everyone to see what had happened. And I looked at the referee commission, the table, and I kind of put my finger up, like, hey, that's something, you know. And, of course, you know, they were like, you know what? They look at the video. They're like, yeah, that's a score. That's Ivone. So, they put their hand up. They give me the win. I'm starting to walk off the mat. I'm like, man, in my mind, I can't believe it.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't at my best today, and I'm in the freaking semi. Sweet, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm starting to walk off the mat, and all of a sudden the head guy comes over. He says, no, Ivone, get back on the mat. Keep fighting. And so I keep fighting. But now, see, if I had a coach there, he might have fought for me. He might have helped me.
Right.
You know, he might have said, no, Effie Pone, of course Effie Pone.
Right.
I'll show you the way. You know, maybe, maybe not, but it, you know.
At least you don't have to think about fighting for it.
Right. In the back of my mind, I'm like, well, should I argue? What am I going to do? Okay, you know what? Forget it. I can't do anything about it now. Keep fighting.
Right.
And I kept fighting, and then after the match, I'm going to try and explain my case. But, you know, as well as I do, it's not going to help. I go over there to make an ass out of myself. And, you know, they're just... That's where a coach would help. That's where somebody like Jimmy or Jason or anyone really in that situation will help, you know? So
yeah.
It's like, that's what's, you know, just to give you an example, that's what can kind of be tough. You know, you have to get your credentials, register for the tournament, figure out practice times, this, that, the other thing, payment, blah, 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 you know, times, all the stuff, schedules, bus times, it's just nuts, and you need a manager, and you need a staff
right.
there, you do.
Yeah.
You look at all these other teams, Russia, Japan, Mongolia, Korea, all these successful teams, France, Brazil, they have a staff. They have more staff there than athletes.
Right.
You know, and it seems silly to do that, but then you look at their dominance, and you're like, why is it silly? You know?
Right. Yeah, because there's a lot of little details that to be taken care of, but outside of that, I hate to ask the question, but just psychologically going alone, does it just get, you know, you're cutting weight, does it get lonely?
Absolutely. I mean, I say it, and I, you know, if we're being honest, I say it every time I come back home. I'll say it to my mom, my girlfriend, or my dad, and my sensei, man, it's really lonely, especially when you go to a place like human Russia, you know, out in
yeah.
the middle of nowhere, or, you know, Azerbaijan or Abu Dhabi, and you go alone, and it's like, oh man, you know, like this is lonely. You know, like you know it's lonely. You don't want to think about it. You just want to keep pushing through and put your head down and not think about it. But it's lonely and it stinks and it's dreary and it's depressing.
Right.
So it is, yeah.
Well, you're awesome, man. The passion keeps driving you forward. That's great.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, if you know, knock on wood, if I have it my way, my body holds up. You know, I keep doing what I want to do elsewhere in life, as you know, with my family and my studies and all of these things. But and I'll compete till I'm 50 if I can. You know, I love judo. I love judo. I love judo's my passion. But I think I really love competing in judo. I like
right.
you know, showing up to a tournament, and seeing if I'm better, seeing if I'm, you know, if I can throw this guy, or you know, yeah. what I'm worth that day. You know, that's why I love competing. I love competing. That's why I think that's what I really love. Judo's great. Don't get me wrong. I love judo. It's my passion. But competitive judo is where it's at. You know, I love it. So.
Yeah, well, it definitely comes out in your judo. It's a really dynamic player, exciting to watch. So you've had an opportunity to train at several places with Jimmy and Jason. But so I'm sure, and now in Miami. Your training partners over that time, over the last several years, have changed. How have the different people, I mean, coaches are important, but the training partners really define as well your development, right? So how have the training partners affected you?
Not a whole terrible lot. I mean, not a whole lot.
Are there people that, you're one of the best people in the world at 73 kilos. Are you able to find people that challenge you on the
sure.
mat?
Sure, but you're just getting at my answer. You know, we're in a country that's, or even a continent that's super big, right? We have a lot of mass, and not a whole lot of people do judo, and not a whole lot of people are that good at judo.
Right.
Not a whole lot of people are around my weight that are that good at judo. So yeah, in that respect, it's super difficult to find opponents. You know, around here in Miami, in the United States, even in this region, you know, in this geographic region, it's hard to find people, you know,
right.
So that's why last year I traveled like crazy. I was on the road competing and training all from pretty much February till the world. I was on the road the whole year. So that's why I'm home, like, kind of deactivating myself, and I got a couple of injuries. I'm all dinged up and competing and training so much because, you know, we're in a country that's this big and only this many people do judo, whereas you go to a place like Ukraine and the country's so small, but so many people do judo. So it's, that's why I'm competing and training so much, and that's what I'm doing to get over that challenge of finding decent bodies, because it's, you know, it's, it gives your system some shock when, you know, you're beating everyone's butt in the dojo at back home, and then you show up to France for your competition, you get smoked in the competition, you get smoked in the camp, and you're thinking, I was doing so well at home, you know, it has nothing to do with that, you know, you gotta, if you're the best guy in the room, something's wrong, you know, you gotta stop right there.
I think I've often heard high-level competitors talk about, like, a turning point. Was there like, an opponent you beat or a tournament you won that made you realize that, you know what, I could be the best in the world at some point in your development? Maybe when you beat Bobby Lee in 2008 or whatever?
Well, all right, the series I had with Bobby Lee in 2006, that was like the junior world team. It was a turning point in the, not in the sense of, oh, I can be the best in the world, but it was a turning point in, okay, I wanna commit myself to this.
Got it.
Yes, I can be very good at this. And yes, I wanna devote the rest of my youth to this, you know, so that's what made me devote ages 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22 to judo, was that series with Bobby. But in terms of, you know, winning a match or winning a tournament where I said, oh, man, I think I can be the best in the world, I think that came in, well, to be honest with you, it's happened a couple times where, a tournament has reminded me that I am this good, you know. But
right.
I think the very first time I got a taste of, oh, you know, maybe I am pretty good, is when it was really just the whole summer of 2010. You know, I think I won these lower level World Cups in Venezuela and El Salvador.
Yeah.
You know, I think I beat Michael Eldred at one. I beat a couple of decent South American players at both of them. And I said, oh, you know, I have a pretty good chance. You know, I'm getting better. I'm improving. But then I went to the Worlds that year, and I think I went 3-1. I fought really well. I fought really,
yeah, you
really
did.
Well.
You got ninth. That's one of the best performances of the world in a long time for an American.
So, and it was my first Worlds, and I think that's, that whole summer, cumulatively, I realized, you know, I guess I'm going on here. I think I can be the best, you know, so it's, that's what made me believe.
That's awesome, man. That's about the time, I guess, you climbed up the ranks, quick.
Yeah, for sure. That was my my quickest leap on the world ranking list. You know, I think I was outside the top 100, and all of a sudden I'm in the top 20, 15, and I think that's when I couldn't pinpoint it exactly for you, but around there I said, I think I can do this.
And you can, man.
Thanks.
So in terms of techniques, would you say Uchimata is your favorite technique?
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, I've had Yuneska teaching me, Jason teaching me, so, and these guys are Uchimata specialists, so it's, yeah, I think it kind of came easy. Plus, I think to throw, the way my body's built, I'm short, I have big legs, big torso, you know, I think that throw is kind of made for me in terms of my body build, you know, so, because I used to be a big, you know, Morote Sayanagi player when I was younger junior, but, and I, for whatever reason, I just stopped doing it. I stopped practicing it. Didn't really work on it too much. It was always there, but then, you know, you don't practice it for 2, 3, 4, 5 years, and now it's not there anymore. So it's, you know, where'd that throw go? Well, you didn't practice it. So now I'm trying to bring that back and not so worry so much about Uchimata, because I think that throw, no matter how hard I try, will always be there, because it's the throw that I've, you know, every time I do judo, I do Uchikomi, whether I do Nagikomi, Uchikomi, Randori, I'm always find myself doing Uchimata at some point, so it's always going to be there.
It's there. Well, you also have a very good Yoko.
Thanks. You know, that's one of those throws, I'm not going to call it a trick throw necessarily, but it's one of those throws that gives the opponent a different look.
Yeah.
It's a very specific throw for a very specific type of stance your opponent's giving or a look your opponent's giving, so. And I used to get that look a lot, so that's why I learned the throw, because I was like, you know, if the guy's bent over to number 7, how can I throw him with Uchimata? I can't. Right. It's almost impossible. what throw can I do? And I think Jason's wife, Terry Takimori, she taught me that throw, you know, and worked with me on it. So I have to credit her for that.
Yeah. So maybe you can explain this to me, but when I watch like the lighter weights of 73 kilo, for example, a lot of the guys have a bent over stance and they're kind of, it feels like there's a constant pull backwards. Like they're sort
right.
of, does that make the Uchimata very difficult to throw?
Yeah, it does. And you know, the guys, you're right. It's what they're doing is it almost feels like they're, you know, they grab wherever they grab and then they kind of sit.
Yes.
You know, and it's like, how can I do Uchimata? This guy's going the complete opposite direction. well, that's why there's Oichi and there's Koji and there's Osoto and the switch. And that's why, you know, or the sticker foot or, you know, any of that, or Tomonagi, you know, different directional changes. So that's why, or Osoto Gari. So that's why, you know, I also think with Uchimata, the beauty of the throw is there's a lot of things. If Uchimata doesn't work, like I just said, there's a lot of things to go do. Oichi, Koji, this, that, up, north, south, purple, green. There's a bunch of different ways to go off of Uchimata, you know?
Right.
So, you know, Morote, Sanagi, Tayatoshi, whatever. And I think Uchimata is a pretty versatile throw, and I think that's why, you know, I like it, and it fits in the game, my game, well. So, and plus I'm a lefty, so the majority of players, at least stateside, North American side, majority of players are righties, you know, and then once you get overseas, then you realize 90% of the world's lefty in judo. It's
yeah.
Like, oh my God, this is tough.
did the new rules over, like the recent new rules and the new rules in 2008 or whenever it was, did that change your game drastically?
No, not really. Actually, if anything, it helped it. I didn't really do a, you know, before, when the two-on-one grip break got taken away, it didn't really affect me because I didn't really do a whole lot of gripping, you know, and I'm sorry to say that. I wish I did more. But now I don't because they, you know, they modified it. So it's actually, you know, a blessing that I didn't do more, you know, gripping. But, you know, none of the rule changes really hurt me a lot. You know, I think the most impactful thing was the initial rule change of, you know, you can't grab the leg, but you can grab the leg if you do some sort of technique. That was the first rule change. So then I couldn't really do kata gruma. I spent like 2 or 3 years trying to perfect the kata gruma, finally get it to a scoring throw in shiai. And then as soon as it's incorporated into my game, they take it away, and I'm like, man, I could have been working on, you know, Sode's or Sayanagi's. Oh, what a waste of time! And it's just that stunk. But in regards to the rules and their changes, that's something I want to say, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
You know, I think you look at the judo for the last year, from France, the Paris Open, up until this latest tournament. You can even go as far as Uzbekistan or the World Championships, wherever you want. You know, you look at the percentage of epons, the percentage of matches ending in throws and scores and attire, and you look at it, the judo is a little less. It's more confusing in some ways, but it's less confusing in some ways because, you know, at the Olympics, I had family there, I had friends watching online and whatnot, and they were stumped, man. They had no idea what they were watching. They're, how did you lose that match to Wang? How did your teammate Travis lose to Bischoff?
Yeah.
You know, how do these guys, why are you losing? Or what's going on? Why did that guy lose that match? What's that call for? You know? So that was confusing to a lot of people. And I think what the IGF was trying to avoid was what happened to wrestling. You know, they were very, very hesitant to, you know, keep going with these not odd rules, but, you know, it's not spectator friendly, so I understand what they're trying to do, and I think people also have to understand that the IJF is trying to make judo viewable and spectator friendly and have a lot of dynamic scoring and throws. That's easy to understand. When a guy gets lifted up off the ground and catapulted onto his back by another guy, you know, people know, anyone can see what happened there. Oh, wow, that guy just got owned, you know, so it's easy to see what happened, And I think that's what judo is going for. And if you look at the numbers and you look at – and just when you really look at the whole judo from this whole year and take judo from last year and even judo from the year before that, and you're going to see there's a lot more throwing and a lot more scoring. So I'm all for the rules. Yes, they actually benefit me too. But, you know, if they were to say tonight, all leg grabs apply, all rules apply, judo, old rules again, I wouldn't have a problem with it. You know, it doesn't bother me either way. But I know people are bothered by the rules, and they have to. I think they have to step outside and look why is the IJF doing this instead of, oh, why me? They took away my kataguruma, you know?
Yeah, I think people are always bothered by change, but if you're right, if you objectively look at the numbers, at the results, there are, as a spectator, I can say that there's a lot more exciting throws.
That's what I'm saying. And you know what I mean? Can you honestly say that, though? Can you honestly say there's more throws, more exciting judo? Or do you think it has no effect?
Well, I don't like the new rules as a competitor,
personally,
but as a spectator, so this is one man's opinion, but I think from watching the World Championships, there's more exciting judo. Maybe it's because I watched all the right matches, but there seems to be more. I mean, I'm a big fan of all the rules, the out of bounds with the pin, the gripping. It seems to produce more incentive for the throw.
And I think that's the whole point. And then, you know, when you take away this, it's a really hard rule to adjust to, that two-on-one, you can't break a grip with two hands on one. When you look at that rule, it's like, why would they take away that basic kumi-kata, you know, grip break? Well, because they just want both judoka to grab and go. They're tired of all this hand slapping. And that's, you know, and I'm not bashing kumi-kata or tactical judo. I'm not bashing that. What I'm saying is the IJF, and I think a lot of people want to just see people lock up, lock horns, and see who's better. You know what I mean? Forget, you're only out there for 5 minutes in total for match time. People don't want to, the IJF spectators, they don't want to see us hand fight for 4.5 of it.
Right.
You know what I mean? I hate to say that. You know, and there's a lot of guys that made livings off of tactical kumi-kata judo or, you know, strategy, whatever, that's okay, but it's just it's a new day. It's a new day and age, and, you know, the IJF is calling the shots, and they say, okay, we want to see both guys come high and one guy get thrown with Osoto. Go.
Yeah.
You know, so.
And I think a lot of those changes are good, and wrestling made a lot of good changes. Being threatened to be taken out at the Olympics. And you used to, I mean, like I mentioned, and you, I think, said, you used to wrestle and quite successfully, but you were stopped by a major injury, ACL, MCL, meniscus. How did you, that was your sophomore year in high school, how did you mentally deal with that injury? Did you want to quit at that point? Was there a moment where you just wanted to quit sports completely?
No, never. I mean, it's like I said. Even then, it's I'm just too active. It can't happen. It can't happen. But you know, I get, you know, super injured. They're telling me my season's over. I'm, you know, favored to make the final of states that year, whatever weight class I was wrestling. So it was pretty hard.
130, I think.
actually, I think it was 130 or 135.
That's how much you weigh, but I think if your body is correct, then you actually had to wrestle up a weight class.
I had to wrestle up my freshman year, but my sophomore year, I actually wrestled a weight class lower my sophomore year, if that makes sense.
Nice.
You know, I get injured, I'm just like, oh, this really stinks. You know, I can't win a state wrestling title on the sidelines, you know, so I the doctor tells me I can't wrestle anymore, and I couldn't wrestle. I couldn't get low. I couldn't get in a stance. I couldn't shoot a shot. I couldn't defend too hard on my knee. But what I could do after some rehab, like 4 months of rehab, I noticed I could kind of do a little bit of judo. You know, I could do a chikomi. I could do a little gripping. As long as I didn't have to get low, I could do judo, you know. So I started doing judo, started messing around with it again. And then sure, like 3 months after it, you know, for whatever reason, my knee recovery was super quick. I think I rehabbed really well. And my rehabilitation specialists were very good too, but It was quite easy.
Which leg was it on?
It was my right knee.
So it's your posting knee. It's here for like the Uchimata.
Yep. It's my supporting leg. You know.
So was there moments when you're like, so it's your posting leg for everything, for Ouchi, Osoto.
Yep.
So did you have confidence issues? A lot of people when they go through knee injury, there's that psychological barrier.
Initially there was a little bit, yeah. But then in hindsight, I'm thinking about it now. I was pretty reckless. I just wanted to get back so bad, so quick,
yeah,
so fast, and be, you know, just do whatever I had to do and go where I wanted to go so quickly. I really didn't look back, and I really didn't look down at my knee at any point, you know.
Right.
And there was times it throbbed, and I probably really, you know, shouldn't have been working out as hard as I would have, or should have, or was, you know. And I just did it anyway, just because I was like, oh man.
Yeah, the beautiful injured. The beautiful stupidity of youth.
Right. Yeah. You know, and like, you know, you're. You know, got all these testosterone going. I want to be the man. You know, I want to, you know, make the junior world team. And I had to act quick to get better. So I was like, no, I got to be back on the map by this time. If I want any shot at making the junior world trials, I got to get this many points. I got to be ready to beat this guy by then. You know, so it was like, you know, it all actually worked out well for me. But
yeah, you did really well at that point in terms.
Right,
of
but in hind, like I said, in hindsight, I probably should have took better care of my knee. You know, knock on wood, there's no problem. Even today, it's actually better than my other knee.
In terms of training, what's your regimen like? Do you train? You mentioned that at Jimmy Pedro's, you train really hard,
right?
3 times a day. Has your training changed since then?
Every place is different, right? And I've trained in a lot of different places, at judo and wrestling and grappling and whatnot. And every place is very different. And the scenario I've kind of created for myself right now in Miami. Is and you're gonna laugh when I tell you this, but this is true. The whole program, you know, everything, the lifting program, the running program, the judo program revolves around me, and it's got to revolve around me.
Yeah,
I have to be selfish, you know, like
right, absolutely.
It sounds, you know, it's an individual sport. You got to be selfish. It sounds, you know, kind of conceited and.
No, that's what it is to be a professional athlete. It's
right,
completely and, selfish. Yeah,
and people don't understand that. And then, you know, when you know, Kayla's in Boston. She's that program is heavily revolved around her, and that's okay. And it shows. She's super successful,
yes.
You know. And San Jose State is heavily revolved around Marty, and it shows. She's super successful. And I think in the United States, you almost need a program to give you that kind of support and that kind of backing and that kind of belief and that kind of. Just that kind of, they give you that passion. They all believe in you. They give you their time. They give you their energy. And then you give them the same back on the mat, you know,
right.
and that's what, you know, I think at least in this country really makes success, you know, like, for judo. So I think, you know, maybe not in jiu-jitsu because there's so many people who practice it in wrestling because there's so many people who are good at it and practice it. But in judo, you need that type of team and system and belief and backing and, That's what I kind of created for myself down here.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I invite guys, you know, I say, you know, come train for 2 weeks, I'll pay for it, and, you know, I want you to come train with me. You know, I need guys to come train with me. I need you guys to train down here. And there's a lot of guys training down here originally, but then, you know, every now and then, you know, I have a German friend from Chicago who's used to fight 73, and I invite him down here all the time, and he helps me train before all the big tournaments, you know. So it's a lot of success. Relies on what you do off on and off the mat beforehand, and then you know you need that like I said, that team, that system, that whole support system behind you, you know.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of what I've learned from, you know, Kayla and Marty, is you need that everyone to be behind you, and you need to be selfish, you know.
Absolutely. So in terms of like the specifics, do you? And this is almost like advice for, maybe give advice for other more like recreational players. In terms of how much randori, how much throws, how much fits do you do per day? Is it like, do you do an intense randori session every day or no?
Yeah, I try to. I mean, for me personally, I'm not sure if everyone's the same. I actually know people are not the same, but I have to randori. I have to. If I don't, it's off. Timing's off. Judo's off. Everything's off. Randori is... You know, look, in my personal opinion, that's the number. If you want to get better at judo, you need to randori. If you want to get better at grappling, you need to go live. You need to roll. If you want to get better at wrestling, you got to go live. You know, like you got to. I'm not saying all the time, and there is times and, you know, places for drills and uchikomi and etc. You know, but in strength training, conditioning, you need everything. But if you really want to accelerate, you know. You have to go live, and you have to see real-time techniques with real-time intensity with different types of styles. And
the timing has to be,
let's say for Lex Friedman, right?
Mm-hmm.
You need, and this is the way that I've always trained this way, and it's helped me a lot. You can be very good and get a lot done in the dojo. if you have three types of bodies, a person you're better than that you can practice new techniques on and new grips on, a person that's equaled with you, so you feel like this is a shi'ai, you know, this is me competing, so I'm fighting not to lose, but I'm also fighting to win. I'm trying to throw, but I don't want to get thrown, you know, that's that type of mentality. It's even, it's very, very, we're on pins and needles when we fight, you know, that's how it feels. And then you got to have someone that's better than you, someone that's going to, you know, wreck you. They're going to throw you, they're going to overpower you, they're going to outgrip you, they're going to make you feel uncomfortable. And with these three opponents, you're going to work on things you wouldn't normally work on. You're going to fight like you're in a contest, and you're going to, you know, accept getting thrown and figure out ways not to get thrown, you know? So with these three types of partners, anyone can, and you know, proper guidance and coaching and lifting and running and judo, all that stuff. But with those, if you have three partners, you can, there's no excuse, in my opinion.
And yeah, that's a simple formula. And then right. I guess you try to create that for yourself right now, right?
Right. And, you know, the more bodies, the merrier. You need bodies. You do need bodies. But if you really, really, you need a lefty, you need a righty, all that stuff, you know, as time goes on and it's, the level rises. But, you know, if you, there are nights sometimes where I don't have a body. I have I go with a girl, you know, who's 50 some kilos, and I still make it work. You know, is it what I want? No, it's not what I want. Of course, I want to be in Japan with 100 other guys that all have the ability of Jimmy Pedro or Mike Swain, but it's not like that. It's not realistic. I can do that sometimes, but not all the time, you know, so I have to compensate. And that's why, you know, we in America as judoka, we rely more on, you know, the running and the lifting and the drilling rather than the randori, because we don't have those bodies like Japan or France has. So, you know, I always try to run Dory at a high level, but it's not always going to be that way. So you got to compensate, you know.
So you've competed at in most of your career at 73 kilos.
Almost the whole thing, yeah.
Yeah, I've seen you compete sort of recreationally, like jump into tournaments at 81 kilos,
right.
For the heck of it. Have you? Do you struggle in terms of cutting weight to get down to 73?
If we're speaking truthfully, sometimes, yeah, sometimes.
And is it a tough weight cut?
Sometimes, yes, sometimes. But sometimes it's not, you know, when it's not, I usually do quite well. When it is, I tend to get streaky and inconsistent. But, you know, it's a lesson right there in itself. But usually, for instance, you know, if I'm coming back to Paris, this is going to be my next tournament back this February. It's a long time away without competing. I've competed for, you know, every other weekend for the last 5-6 months, you know. And now I'm going to wait till Paris to compete again. And that first tournament, the weight cut, you know, it might be a little tougher than usual because it's the first time out again. Yeah. But then the next weekend in Austria, it'll get easier. Then in Germany, it'll be easier. Then as time goes on, it just gets easier and your body gets smaller again and gets more accustomed to staying light. But the first cut in a while, you know, that kind of hurts every time. But after that, it's not, you know, it's not that bad. But then, you know, sometimes it, you know, you have to go halfway across the world, get on 3-4 flights to get where you want to be, and you weigh 77, and you're like, man, I'm pretty drained. I don't know how I'm going to lose 4 kilos, you know, in 24 hours, and you find a way to do it, you know. And then sometimes it's, you know, like at Pan Ams last year, I went down there, and I was 73.4, and I couldn't gain weight, you know. I was like, man, it's hard to get heavy, you know. I'm light all the time. So it's just weird. Your body's weird, and for me, it varies, you know, and I think that's what I need to work on. I need to get it more consistent, not varying, you know.
One of the interesting things in, for example, jiu-jitsu is that it's a pretty common practice, especially at the highest levels of black belt, to compete in the absolute division, so in a division where there's no weight classes. But in wrestling and judo, there's very strict adherence to weight classes.
Right.
Do you think technique-wise, since you've competed in 81 kg, and you mentioned you went against Travis, is there a big difference? Do you feel that 20-pound or 15-pound difference, whatever that is the style different?
It's different in every way. That I think that's a definite. You know, the style's going to be different. You know, at 60, you know, the guys are quick and they have a lot of drop techniques and, you know, a lot of yokosutemi waza, you know. But and then at 66, it's a little less of that and a little more power, you know, and then so on and so forth. With increasing power comes, you know, decreasing speed, and but there's always there's dynamic judo at any weight, you know. So it's just just different techniques. Like, and plus it's Harai Makikomi,
right,
and you know, Ogruma and Uranagi rather than drop Rote Sayanagi and Sode Surikomigoshi, you know. So it's different styles, yes. But you know, me personally, I feel as if you're good at if you're a good judoka, you can win at any weight. You'll figure out a way to win, you know. And I think I could, honestly, if I.
Have you ever considered going up to 81 kg?
I consider it every day. Every day.
I mean,
day
do you think it's possible, not even weight-wise, you're still weighing 73 kg. Do you think you can, there's tournaments where you would do better at 81?
Absolutely. There are times where I enter a tournament at 73 and I think I could have done better at the weight above.
Because 73 is arguably one of the toughest divisions.
Yeah. You know, and the thing is, I think, the weight division's tough, but... You know, there's a lot. All divisions are tough. You know what I mean? But
well,
73 is,
yeah.
The 73 is deep. It's deep.
It's
but
deep.
There are guys I look at 81 that I know I match up better than mm-hmm. than guys at 73. And I think I match up better. Like if I had, you know, if I had a good year and a half, 2 years to get really used to 81, I think I could be just as good at the weight, if not better. I think I match up. Honestly, I think I match up better with a lot of guys at 81, better than I do at 73. At 73, you know, there's a lot of a lot of left-handed players that are tall left-handed players that are, you know, have forward techniques. So like a, you know, Hugo Legrand from France, good lefty. Dex Elmont, good lefty. There's another guy. This guy, Jurak Kobolov from Uzbekistan, dangerous lefty that I can't figure out a way to beat yet, you know. So these guys, you know, they're left-handed players that I don't match up that well against at 73. And it's because they're tall, they have speed, they're left. 81, there's left-handed players too, but they're not as quick. They're not going to get under me with that Marote Sayanagi or Sumigaishi as quickly. You know, they're just slower. It's slower pace, and I have slower pace judo to some extent. I have Nuchimata. That's, you know, it's just a slower pace game. You know, I adjust well to 73, but you know, there's not a day that I don't think about. Or a tournament I see where, you know, I think I could have done good at 81 too. Because I do think I can do good. I think I'm a good player. I think I can do good at any weight. Give me 40 pounds, I'll do good at 90. Give me 20, I'll do good at 81. I think I could compete 81 right now at a pretty decent level. I'm not, you know, and I really believe that.
But making that decision, making that switch is a really tough one because...
I mean, I'm already so established at the lower weight. Right. And I know I've competed against the whole weight, the whole world in that weight, you know.
And there's very few people that are going to tell you. What I find is 99.9% of coaches and just the culture drives you to,
right.
Obviously you should do 73 kg. Why would you not do 73 kg? Like, why would you not do the lighter weight?
Because you might be the best guy in the world at 81. You don't know.
Yeah.
You just don't know until you try. Or give it a legitimate try. Will I do that? Probably not. But, you know, you never know.
And you look at somebody like in wrestling, Kyle Dake, who's just won NCAA tournament at four different weight classes.
Exactly. So that's a great example right there. It should tell you that it's possible to not necessarily worry about weight, but if you're good, you can win at any weight. It doesn't matter.
Right.
And it's actually better to not have to worry about that first opponent being the scale. You know, you can just, okay, I'm focused on my first match. I'm going to kill this guy. You know, don't worry about the weight cut. Don't worry about what you're eating. Just, I feel good. I want to kill this guy. You know, not necessarily kill the guy, but I'm going to play smart. Uh-huh. I'm totally, completely focused on the object. You know, or the task at hand. You know, it's winning this match, winning this way, following this tactic or this strategy and executing, you know, not worrying about, oh man, I'm pretty thirsty, you know.
Yeah,
it's like, you know.
Yeah, you might as focus on it.
Right.
You've mentioned that you're going to school now. Are you second year?
Technically, yeah. I'm taking my 6th, 7th, and 8th class now and towards my associate degree in business.
Awesome. So where does school fit into your regimen and the way you look at your career as a judo player?
I go to school online now. I go to college online, and that makes things really easy at the moment. So I can kind of create my own schedule. So, you know.
Are you able to find, like, the mental energy to, you know, together with training?
At the moment, school is coming before judo because, you know, we're still, you know, more than two years.
Right.
More than 2 years away from the Olympics. We're about 3 years away. So there's not so much stress being put on judo at the moment. Rather, you know, school, you know, if I get a hundred or an A on a paper or a test or a quiz.
The gold medal right there.
Exactly. It gives me the same satisfaction, I told this to my girlfriend the other day, as winning a judo shiai or a contest. It does. It really does. It's like, oh, I just, you know, owned that opponent, or I did what I had to do. That's an ippon. Yeah, I just scored ippon for one, five rounds, and I, you know, I got an, or, you know, my GPA right now, it's not, I'm not, like I said, I'm not that far in, but I have a 3.7, and for me, you know, great. I'm, you know, top 10 on the world ranking list right now in school. So it's like, it's the same, right. It really does give me the same amount of satisfaction. So, you know, if I have to miss, you know, God forbid, if I have to miss practice for school, if like a finals, I got to do a final, or I have to write a huge paper and I'm not prepared, or I don't think it's up to snuff, you know, I'm missing judo. And you know about this, you know, you gotta find time, you know, and I find time. And if I get an A on it, which I'm not trying to toot my own horn, but which I usually do, sweet, that was worth it. You know, that was worth it. It's okay to miss practice for school. You know, that was totally worth it.
That's awesome. It's beautiful that you see it that way. And, you know, the school pays off in the long term.
And that's what I'm, you know, I can't say that through experience, but I've heard that phrase used before. It pays off in the long term. And I, you know, I'm trying to make it work, and I'm trying to see the big picture at hand, you know, because I don't want to, you know, get done with judo and say, all right, what now? Where am I going to do? What am I going to do? Where am I going to go? What's going to be my job? You know, I want to have that all, not necessarily taken care of, but I want to be pretty far into it, you know, and I want to have a plan, you know.
Yeah, and you might find that school is a complete waste of time, but you need to go through that school. You need to go there to learn that. Maybe for you, the path will be somewhere else. Like, you'll start your own business, and you won't need everything you've learned in school will be, you'll see as useless, but it's very important to go through that experience.
Right. No, absolutely. No, you couldn't have said it better. And plus, you know, you never know. Like, say if my business venture fails, it's always good to have that degree in the back pocket. You know what I mean? Just to have something there, you know? So it's instead of, hey, I'm really good at judo. Oh, what does that do for you in the workforce? You know, like...
So you were adopted from Montenegro at 2 years old, around that time.
Yep.
And something I just, you know, I was reading about a lot. There's statistic. There's 145 million orphans worldwide. And the most stunning number is really 87 million orphans in Asia and 43 million in sub-Saharan Africa. I know you may be too young to remember. I know you visited the orphanage recently, but you may be too young to remember, but what is life like in an orphanage? What future does a child have without parents?
Well, personally, the orphanage I came from, there is no future. If you're not, you know, you know, chosen by a family by the time you're three or four, it's it. You know, you're done. You basically spend the rest of your days there until you're old enough to join the army. They put you in the army and you're good to go, you know, and that's, you know, a very few kids go to, I mean, I visited 2-3 years ago, the orphanage I come from, and one kid had graduated from college, one. The rest went to the army or became nothing. So, you know, you walk in there, and it's, of course, it's depressing. Either all the kids, you walk into a room, and there's like, doesn't matter how many kids are in there. If there's one, there's seven, there's 100. They'll all stand up at once and look towards your direction because they're, you know, they're presenting themselves to you. You know, and that sucks. You know, that it gets at you, and especially for me, you know, and that, you know, it's not a hard subject for me to talk about at all, but I find myself every day like realizing more and more, man, like this, me being an orphan and me being so fortunate has had a huge impact on my life in so many ways that it shows subconsciously. Like, you know, I have four rescue cats. Four out of five. I'm a cat weirdo. I'm a weird cat guy.
Yeah.
And it's not because I love cats, but I don't have this huge obsession with cats. It's that they were just like me. They were orphans. One was in the street dying. The other one has one eye. Two were in a barn. And I took them all. My girlfriend and I, we took them all because I feel now in hindsight, looking back on it, that I can relate. You know. That sucks. So it's, I think it shapes a lot of who I am. You know, like, being so fortunate and realizing what I have, where I came from. So, you know, and it makes, it molds my personality, you know, and it has a lot to do with who I am and what I want to be, where I want to go, what I want to do, you know, so it's.
And what role did your parents play in your life in terms of, you know, in terms of judo, in terms of everything, is your development as just as a guy, as a man?
Everything. And without them, first of all, without them, I wouldn't be here. Second of all, I wouldn't even be a judoka without my dad, to tell you the truth. I mean, I really can't say it's destiny because, I mean, it is, but, you know, he took me to, he practiced karate at the Cranford Judo Karate Center.
Yes.
For however many years, and, you know, he took me there expecting to practice karate. I practice karate. I find out that it's not like Power Rangers. I hate it. I want to go home. I see judo afterwards as I'm, you know, velcroing up my shoes, you know, I see judo going on, and I'm like, oh my gosh, what is this? Like, you know, so I immediately take off my shoes, tell my dad, I'm going to try that, you know, I'd like to try that, I'd like to get back out there and do that. And then, and I've had a love-hate relationship with it ever since, more love than hate.
And he helped, was he instrumental in getting you to Jason Morris originally? Do you remember?
Well, what used to happen was, my family and I, there used to be this tournament in Maryland we would go to every year. It was in Beltsville, I believe, you know, some boonies, you know. And we would go there every year, and it was a good local tournament. I'd fight, you know, get my money's worth, 3, 4, 5 divisions, you know, get 12 to 15 matches for, you know, a low amount of money. And
yes.
Terry Takamori was always there because her family lives in that area, around that area, and they would help with the tournament, and she would always be out there. And so she saw me fight one year. She gave, you know, she helped me. She helped my sister because she's also a judoka. And she, you know, she talked to our parents. She gave them a flyer. She said, you know, your kids are pretty good. They have a lot of potential. Maybe they should come try this camp with my husband. He's Jason Morris. All the credentials came afterward. You know, we were blown away. It was pretty cool for me and my family. So then, you know, we realized, hey, we're only 3 hours away from him. That's pretty close, you know. So we checked it out. And that was it. You know, Jason said, you know, I'd like to try, you know, making you a full-time student. And I was really young, too. I was only 12 when I decided to move there. But, like, from 12 to 14, I can honestly say I was pretty good at 12 to 14. I was pretty advanced from 12 to 14. I think, technically speaking, I might have known more then than I did now. Because, you know what's funny? I had less bad habits in judo. I wouldn't bend at my back, you know. I wouldn't...
Right. You listened to the coaches, and you just did all the things as they were
telling me to do, right? That there was no, you know, it's like a computer. There was nothing to fix. There was no there was no viruses on it.
He got me fresh and new.
He got me right out of the package, so he could put what he wanted on me. You know, he put all the good stuff on me. He gave me, you know, all these good tools, and it gave me a lot of confidence too. And he really made me believe, like, again, that I could beat anybody. So then, you know, now it's like I have all these doubts. I'm older, and I'm, you know, I have all these, you know, worse habits over time. And it's like, oh, man, I think I was, technically speaking, I was probably better then. But, you know, physically and experience-wise, of course not, you know, so.
So have you met your birth parents yet?
Long story short, I met my birth father. I didn't really meet him. I came face to face with him, but it was a really awkward experience. Long story short,
you didn't speak.
Nope. But we are identical. I mean, he's me 3 inches, 4 inches taller, with long hair and a mustache. He looks like a mixture between me and a young Willie Nelson. I'm serious. Like, yeah. he really. I saw him from maybe 50 yards away, and I said, well, I mean, that's me in 20 years. that's me. It's me. Bigger and, a little more, you know, just old. Just older.
Yeah, age catches up with you. But maybe when you get the gold in 2016, you can bring that to him.
Yeah, you know, I think when it's all said and done, you know, I don't want to wait, you know, too late, but I just wasn't ready then to say, you know, to my bit and say hi or whatever. So I think when... You know, and I think it's because I'm so focused on what I need to focus on and what I need to get done. Yeah. And when I get that done and when I pass that part of my life, I think then I'll have to, you know, hey, I'm Nick, I'm your son, here's who I am, this is what I've done, this is what I've been doing with my life, I'd like to get to know you. You know what I mean? So I just wasn't ready yet because I don't want to introduce that into my life yet because I have to be selfish, you know. It sounds kind of messed up, but it's true.
No, absolutely
true.
It's the different roles you take on as an athlete. You have to be 100% selfish. As a coach, you have to be you know, 100% selfless.
Right.
It's a very kind of different roles. So in that same interview where you mentioned you like Game of Thrones, you mentioned that you also play a little StarCraft, at least at the time, StarCraft 2.
Oh, yeah.
So I have to ask, are you as competitive about StarCraft as you are about Judo?
You know, with online gaming or any gaming, any game, it doesn't matter if it's horseshoes. I'm trying to win, you know.
Yeah.
It's just if I stink at the certain thing, I can't. My chances of winning are a lot less. At StarCraft 2, I think, as you know, the way their match system is set up, you almost always win every other game. You almost go about 50% just because of the way the ladder's set up. But I stink, man. I'm pretty bad. Like,
well, yeah, there's always going to be a 12-year-old who is going to kick your ass a little bit.
I get roughed up quite a bit. But, yeah, so, I try to win as much as I can, but I'm just not as good.
Well, forget judo for a second. Do you believe you're the best StarCraft II player of all the Olympic judo hopefuls in your division? Like, if you had to...
No, I'm not. I know I'm not. There's a guy from Canada, this kid, Alexi Morin-Marteau, is actually in my weight category. And he's, like, diamond in 1v1, 2v2. He's, like, semi-pro. And he's a Zerg player. And I played with him, and he just toys with me. He just messes around with me. And there's another guy that's actually in my weight. I don't know if I call him an Olympic hopeful anymore. I think he's kind of done with judo. His name is Justin Imagawa. He's from Canada, too. He's a ProDOS player, same statistics, same credentials as the other guy. They're both very good, so they could both, you know, blow me out of the water in StarCraft too.
Well, I was going to issue a sort of a public challenge from Nick Del Popolo to the rest of the, but I guess you've already given up on that, yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess you're going to have to stick to judo.
Yep.
Yeah, man. Thanks so much for talking to me today.
No problem.
People want to reach you, they should go to nickdelpopolo.com or
absolutely.
Twitter, Nick for Gold.
Yep. You know, talk to me on Twitter, talk to me on my Facebook, website, wherever. Usually, if I'm not halfway across the world missing a flight, I can write back real quick or, you know, answer whatever, you know, any inquiries anyone needs me to answer or just talk, you know. So, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, man, you've been really gracious with your time. Thanks so much.
Yeah, no, don't mention it, Lex. Anytime.